ready to be done. Just one more chapter left, and it's not actually a very long chapter, so we are almost done. This last chapter is called The Chromosomal Basis of Inheritance. So it's some of it just looks at things we've already looked at, but from the viewpoint of the chromosome. For instance, this opening slide, this is a cross that we've looked at already in a previous chapter, the P seed one. What kind of cross is this, by the way? Did we say? Right, it's dihybrid. And what are the two reasons that it's dihybrid? What, or any cross that's dihybrid, what two things makes it dihybrid? Right, the di part of the word refers to the fact that we're simultaneously paying attention to two characteristics rather than just one. What are those characteristics here? Texture is one, seed texture.
And color?
And seed color, yes. And the hybrid part of the word means what? Well, what about the parents? There are going to be parents in any cross. But what makes it a hybrid?
Is it two parents?
Well, there's going to be two parents in every cross if it's a sexual species. Right. The fact that it's a hybrid means that the two parents of the P generation are different in their traits for whatever characteristic is being studied. So for a monohybrid cross, for instance, remember that flower color one we started with. The one parent was purple-flowered, one was white-flowered. Here we have two characteristics, and each parent is different in the trait for that, for both of those characteristics. So you have a green, smooth, or round seeded individual crossed with a yellow round seeded individual crossed with a green wrinkle seeded. And so specifically in this case, the yellow round one is a doubly homozygous dominant individual because yellow is dominant in color over green, and smooth or round is dominant over wrinkled. The other one is a doubly homozygous recessive individual. And so those phrases, doubly homozygous dominant and doubly homozygous recessive, should make sense with respect to the genotypes that are shown. Not right? First of all, the genotypes of the parents are four letters long. Why four letters? There's two characteristics and therefore two genes that we're talking about. That's why there are two kinds of letters. That's why there's a Y and an R. Why are there four overall letters? In other words, why two Ys and two Rs? Because they are diploid, right? These are diploid individuals, just like we are. The parents, that is. By the way, speaking of genotypes, what does any individual symbol in a genotype represent? For instance, a single Y. What does one of the Ys in this genotype represent?
Would it be characteristic?
Not exactly. The fact that it's a Y kind of corresponds to a characteristic because there's the so-called Y gene and the R gene. But I'm talking about a specific instance of a Y, meaning what does a capital Y, for instance, actually represent, or a lowercase y? An allele, exactly. Every individual symbol in a genotype represents an allele. Well, a diploid individual has two alleles for whatever gene you're talking about, right? Because there's one allele on each of the two homologous chromosomes that makes that individual diploid. That's why there are two of each kind of symbol in a diploid genotype, two Ys and two Rs in this case, because we're looking at two different genes. All right, so what wasn't shown the first time we looked at this exact cross was the chromosomes themselves. We've been talking about genes and alleles and crosses, but we've kind of been pretending that genes are their own little packages. They're not, of course, right? It's important to keep in mind that any given allele, which is a version of a gene, is really just part of a chromosome. And there are thousands of other genes on that same chromosome. And genes don't individually move around. Genes go where the chromosome they're part of goes. All right? And so that's why you have the cartoons of the actual chromosomes involved here. Now there's how many kinds of chromosomes shown on the parents? Two. Why do you say two? Because you ask whether it is rather than saying it confidently. It is two, but why did you say that? Yes, there are four total chromosomes in each of the parent cells. But why are they two kinds? Why isn't it four kinds, in other words? Right. That is right, but what is that? Why does that explain it? In a diploid, you have two of each kind of chromosome, right? So which of the two, since there's two kinds, that means there's two of each kind, right? Shown here. How do you know which two are the same kind? Well, size should match, that's true. If they're the same kind of chromosome, they should be the same size. But how else could you tell? If the two kinds that are here happen to be the same size, which is possible, how do you know? And they roughly are here. Those aren't really drastically different sizes. How else do you know, though, from this cartoon, which two are the same kind? Right. The two chromosomes carrying alleles of the same gene. The ones with the two Ys are the same as each other. The ones with the two Rs are the same as each other. Right? And what is it, what word do we use to describe the position that an allele occupies on whatever chromosome it's on? It's locus, right. The plural of which is loci. So the gene loci that we're interested in, because we're only interested in two genes here, are indicated in cartoon form on these by these black marks on the chromosomes. They're also labeled with letters to show you which particular allele it is, but that's what the little black mark means. That's the actual locus of that particular gene. All right? Now, there are two kinds of chromosomes here, one that's carrying the Y gene and one that's carrying the R gene, but that's not the N of pea plants. Peas have a much higher N than 2. I actually don't know what the number is, but it's not 2. Which means that there are additional chromosomes here in these cells. They are really there. We just don't care about them at all because they aren't at all involved in, they don't carry either of these two genes that we're interested in. So all the other gene, or all the other chromosomes we're ignoring entirely. We're just showing the ones that carry the two genes we're interested in. And also, it's possible for two genes to be on the same chromosome, of course, but in this case, they're not. They're on separate chromosomes. Okay, now, for a cross to occur, the parents, whatever they are, first have to individually make gametes, right? Because a cross represents fertilization. Fertilization is fusion of gametes. So these are diploid parents, as we were talking about. And therefore, what process produces their gametes? Meiosis. Because meiosis has to reduce the ploidy. You want the gamete to be haploid, so that when two gametes get together, you're back to just diploid rather than building it up. We've been through this before. So if you're a diploid, then you produce your gametes by meiosis. And that's why meiosis is listed here. Meiosis, though, makes multiple cells, of course, each of which is a gamete. But as far as the two chromosomes of each type that the diploid parent had in the cell, one of those is randomly chosen by meiosis to be in a particular gamete, a sperm or an egg. Well, these are doubly homozygous individuals, which is another way of saying doubly true breeding, right? And since they're homozygous, if all we care about are the color gene and the texture gene, then each of these parents can make only one kind of gamete. All the gametes are really distinct, of course, if you consider all genes, but we're not. We're considering just color and texture. Well, if they're both homozygous for both of these genes, then it doesn't matter which uppercase Y you pick, which chromosome you pick. You're going to get a chromosome with an uppercase Y from that one, and an uppercase R from this one as well. It doesn't matter which one you choose on the other one as well, either, because it's true breeding. So that's why only one gamete is listed for each of these parents, because meiosis, no matter how it picks randomly, is going to get an upper R and an upper Y for this one, and a lower Y and a lower R for that one. All right? But we see the chromosomes because of the fact that genes don't individually move, even though we've been kind of talking about it that way. Genes are part of chromosomes. So when fertilization occurs, the fusion of those two gametes, there is once again only one possibility. Now you could bother, I guess I will to make the point, to draw a Punnett square for this. But this gamete, there's only one type, right? Upper R, upper Y. The other one is lower R, lower Y. It's a pretty trivial Punnett square. It has just one box in it. Upper R, lower R, upper Y, lower Y. That's the only possible zygote when all you care about are these two genes that these two particular parents can produce. Well, this is nothing new. Before we looked at this slide, when we looked at this cross originally, we already learned that when you have true breeding parents, the F1 generation that they produce as offspring are going to be heterozygous. All of them are going to be, because that's the only possibility. We're looking at two genes here, so this is a double heterozygous individual. And because both of these two genes are Mendelian, and do you remember what that means? What are the two requirements for genes to be Mendelian? There have to be exactly two alleles, not more. And one of them has to completely dominate over the other. So you not only have dominance here, you have complete dominance, and that's why all of the F1s, because of that complete dominance and because they're heterozygous for each of the two genes, should be dominant for both of the characteristics. In other words, every one of these F1s should have yellow seeds and smooth seeds. And they do. We've already talked about that. Right? 100% of them do. All right, well, then when you get to this part of the slide, you have these boxes we haven't talked about. So this is kind of new information. The left box, notice, is labeled the law of segregation. These two boxes are two laws that Mendel himself came up with, even though he had no idea what a chromosome is. Well, you have the so-called law of segregation and the law of independent assortment. Let's talk about segregation first. What does that mean in everyday language? What does it mean to segregate? To separate, put things in separate places. Exactly. And so as you see here, the law of segregation says that the two alleles, which a diploid has, right? By definition, a diploid has two alleles for a gene, separate during gamete formation. Well, he didn't know the molecular particulars of that, but we do now. What specific part of the process is the law of segregation referring to? When, in other words, do those alleles segregate? Specifically. In what? You said two different things. What did you say? More specifically. Anaphase 1. Right, not anaphase 2. Anaphase 1. Remember that anaphase 1 is when the ploidy gets reduced in half. And that's because one cell is going to get one of the alleles, one of the chromosomes carrying that allele, and the other one's going to get the homologous chromosome. They'll be in different cells at that point. So those cells that result will now no longer have two chromosomes. They'll have just one of each type. That's why they are now haploid. So that's what law of segregation is specifically referring to. Anaphase 1 of meiosis. Now the law of independent assortment obviously has to do with independent assortment, and we've covered this before. Not as a law, but I've told you about independent assortment. I specifically told you that it's one of three important ways in which sex drastically increases the genetic variation, right? Assuming you already have genetic variation due to mutation, which we do. Well, what did I say just assortment as a single word refers to? Never mind independent yet. What is assortment to begin with?
Is that like selection?
Well, in everyday language, but I'm talking about in meiosis language. Assortment refers to a specific thing. Well, this actually occurs before segregation. What is it that occurs before anaphase, which is when segregation occurs? What's before anaphase 1? Metaphase 1. And metaphase 1, like all metaphases, whether it's mitosis or either of the two metaphases in meiosis, what happens in general during metaphase of any type? Things line up halfway, exactly. But importantly, what specifically lines up in metaphase 1? No. Sister chromatids are the two parts that make up one replicated chromosome. And so sister chromatids are not individual things yet because they haven't separated. So they can't line up. Homologous pairs of chromosomes are what line up during metaphase 1. You can see that right here. These are two homologous pairs. It's not four replicated chromosomes that are lining up. It's two homologous pairs of chromosomes. Now, a homologous pair of chromosomes that have synapsed and are now basically one unit can also be called what? It's another name for a synapsed pair of homologous chromosomes.
Tetrad?
A tetrad, exactly. So that's what really lines up during metaphase. Tetrads. This is a tetrad. This is a tetrad. And there are other tetrads, we just don't care about those other chromosomes in this experiment because they have nothing to do with color or texture. All right? Well, back to my original question about assortment. Assortment itself refers to how a single tetrad, in other words, one pair of homologous chromosomes, lines up during metaphase. Now, temporarily think about mitosis. It's not pairs of chromosomes that line up. It's replicated chromosomes containing two identical chromatids, right? Sister chromatids. There's only one way for it to line up. You can turn it around, but since these are identical chromatids, it doesn't matter. Not true for a tetrad, though. A tetrad has a replicated chromosome and a replicated chromosome that's the same type, but not identical to it. These came from different parents originally, right? So this versus this is different. You know, in the red-blue scheme that we've been using, it's blue to the left, red to the right is different from the other way around. But assortment refers to how that one tetrad lines up. And it's random. So since there's two possibilities, it's essentially a coin flip. All right? That's assortment by itself. Independent assortment says that each tetrad doesn't care what the other tetrads are doing. Each tetrad flips its own coin. Rather than one coin being flipped by the cell, which would say all the reds go this way, all the blues go this way. Instead, each tetrad flips its own coin and lines up either red to the left or red to the right. Which is why if you have two chromosomes that you're talking about like we do here, only not because there are two overall, but because there are two we care about, there are two possibilities. Remember I gave you that overall formula of 2 to the n minus 1 power? Where n is however many they have. Well, n is higher than 2 here, but these are the only two involved. So 2 to the 2 minus 1 is 2 to the 1, which is two possibilities. These are the two possible ways that two tetrads can line up. With reds going together and blues going together, or with reds and blues being separated. All right, that's independent assortment. And that happens during, specifically, metaphase one of meiosis. So, law of independent assortment, as far as where it is in the process, is just before segregation. You have to line up first, and then you segregate. And that's why, well, that's just part of the reason why the four gametes that are made are not only different from the original cell, of course, because they're haploid rather than diploid, but they're also different from each other. There's another reason, though, that we've ignored in this slide why all the gametes are different. What is that? Independent assortment is one of the three major reasons why sex increases genetic variation. It's the second to occur, though. What's the first to occur? Crossing over. And we've pretended that crossing over didn't occur here, even though it usually does. That's why there's no chromatid that's both red and blue, partially red and partially blue. Actually, though, that does happen, and that's why all four will be completely genetically distinct from each other. And all the other gametes that that parent will make for the rest of its life will be different still because of so many ways that crossing over can occur. Okay, anyway, this is what happens at the chromosome level. The alleles are moving to certain cells, but not as individual alleles. They're moving as passengers, more or less, kind of like passengers on a ship, which is a good analogy for a vehicle because the inside of a cell is liquid. But, you know, all of the alleles on that chromosome are moving together, not individual alleles. All right, now to two. And we're going to look at an example that involves eye color in fruit flies, which is what we're looking at here. Fruit flies are members of a genus called Drosophila. And Drosophila are used in a lot of different genetics experiments. Not necessarily eye color. A lot of different things are tested with Drosophila for various reasons, one of which is they're really easy to raise. They don't die very easily in the lab. Plus, importantly, a generation for them is only about a week. So you don't have to spend years and years getting a decent number of generations. You can just go through a generation per week. So there's actually many different eye colors, and we're not going to talk about the other genes that affect eye color. We're going to just focus on one gene that affects eye color in this case. And so there are only two eye colors that we're concerned with here, which are the normal wild type. This red one is the wild type. Remember, wild type means the trait that most individuals in natural populations have. So, you know, if you actually see fruit flies in your house, like leaving bananas out or whatever, you don't even have to put them under a dissecting scope. Just with your naked eye, you can tell that most of them have red eyes, this reddish color. But sometimes you see a white-eyed, and that's the mutant form that we're talking about here. So two different alleles for one gene, eye color is the characteristic. All right, now slide three, let's look at the actual cross. This is going to look like it's the same as what we've talked about before, just another example, but it's not. We start, though, with a parental generation as usual. And so it looks like what kind of cross to you? Monohybrid, exactly. And in fact, it is an example of a monohybrid cross. But the reason it's monohybrid, of course, is because we're only paying attention to one characteristic, eye color, and the parents are different in their trait for that. So it's a monohybrid cross. But looking at that row of the on the top, the P generation, what information is there that we did not care about at all before?
Sex.
Right, the sex of the parents. So in case you don't already know, that's the female symbol, that's the male symbol. We never cared about this before because it didn't matter at all. You know, the 3-to-1 ratio and the 9-to-3 to 3-to-1 ratio that we've been talking about for the F2s of crosses involving Mendelian genes, those had nothing to do with sex. So for instance, the flower color one that we started with. You'll get exactly the same numerical answers if you go through with that P, F1, and F2 for flower color. Whether it's, you can do it either with purple male, purple flowered male, and white flowered female, or the other way around. It doesn't matter at all. Here, it does matter, and that's why sex is listed. All right? Now, I said it's going to look like it's the same thing. It's confusingly similar, but it's really not. The reason it looks like it's the same is that when you cross these individuals and make the F1, every one of the F1s will have red eyes, just like every one of the purple flowered F1s in the flower color example, even though this is not just another example of that. And also, it looks similar when you go to the F2. When you cross the F1s, two of these with each other, then notice in the F2, 3/4 of the overall individuals are red-eyed and 1/4 is white-eye. So that's what looks like it's the same results. But this is not the same 3-to-1 ratio as we had for purple-flowered and white-flowered pea plants. And that's because, well, notice that the way it is, it just happens to be 3-to-1 overall, but what it is 100% of the females are red-eyed in the F2, 50% of the males are red-eye, and 50% of the males are white-eye. So that's not what happened with the pea plant. For the 3-to-1 phenotypic ratio in flower color, what it meant is that overall there's 75% purple-flowered and 25% white-flowered. That means overall 75% of the females are purple and 25% of the females are white. And the same thing for males. 75% of the males are purple and 25% are white. That's not what's happening here. Well, the rest of the slide below the word conclusion explains why at the chromosome level. Do you remember when we looked at karyotypes? We looked at just one karyotype. It was a human karyotype. And at that time, we distinguished two categories of chromosomes. What are those categories? Autosomes, which in humans would be numbers 1 through 22 there's 23 total kinds of chromosomes in humans. 1 through 22 are autosomes, and what's the other? What's the 23rd pair called in humans? Sex chromosomes. Okay, both of these are chromosome types. But autosomes in a diploid occur in truly homologous pairs. Meaning, let's say number 5, for instance, in humans. The two number 5s are truly homologous. They are the same size, they have the same number and type of genes, just not necessarily the same alleles for those genes. But they govern the same set of characteristics. All right? That's truly homologous. Sex chromosomes aren't truly homologous. It's different for different species. But for fruit flies and for us humans, for instance, we actually both use the same system, the so-called XY system. X and Y are two different versions of the sex chromosome. And they're not truly homologous. We use the word homologous because they do correspond to each other, and they do come together even during meiosis. But they are not truly homologous because they don't have the same number of genes. Because one of them, the X chromosome, is bigger than the other, the Y chromosome. Meaning that the X chromosome contains a bunch of genes that aren't on the Y chromosome at all. Okay, that's not true for any autosome. Up to now, all of the genes that we've been considering have been autosomal genes, genes that occur on one of the autosomes, which means that in a diploid, every individual, regardless of sex, is going to have two alleles for that gene, one on each of the two chromosomes that are homologous autosomes. All right, you following all these definitions? That's not true when it comes to a sex chromosome, though, which is what this gene happens to be. Now, if a gene is on a sex chromosome, we say that the gene or the characteristic that it corresponds to is sex-linked. Sex-linked, that phrase does not mean that it has anything to do with sex. Sex-linked simply means that it is linked, it is part of a sex chromosome. Sex chromosomes get their name as a category because they are somehow involved in determination of the sex of offspring. But that doesn't mean that all of their genes have anything to do with sex. They just happen to be on the chromosome that also determines sex. All right, so sex link does not necessarily mean it has anything to do with sex. But since the two sexes differ in their makeup of sex chromosomes, that's going to then the sex of individuals is going to matter when it comes to how these genes operate. All right, and we can see that here by looking at the little cartoons of the parents. So we're starting over. These parents are exactly these, but now we're looking at their chromosomes. All right, now this is a, well, first let me tell you that you have to look out. This is, unfortunately, they're using another standard here for genotypes. We've already been used to, so far, using an initial that stands for the dominant trait, right? Like P for purple, uppercase P for dominant, lowercase P for white. Well, here we're using an initial that stands for the recessive. W is for white, which is recessive to red. But if it's, instead of being white, it's the wild type, then we put a plus superscript. So W plus means red. W by itself means white. I just realized that. So you can see from this cartoon that this mother, the female parent, well, first of all, she is a female by genetically speaking, she's a female because she has two X chromosomes. That's how the XY system works. XX makes you genetically a female. So she has two X chromosomes, and that's where the locus for the eye color gene is. Therefore, she has two alleles, as you would expect for an autosome, but this is a sex chromosome, for eye color. And they happen to both be the wild type dominant allele. So she's true breeding, red-eyed, or wild type adult. All right? Well, genetically speaking, a male in the XY system is an individual that has one X and one Y chromosome. So that's why he is a male. He's XY. And because this is a sex-linked characteristic or gene, the allele is on the X but not on the Y. So he has only one allele. She has two. He has only one. And that's different from an autosome, right? If this were an autosome, he would also have two. Okay, well, using terms that we've already defined, you could correctly call this female homozygous dominant. But in the case of a sex-linked gene, when it comes to a male, the word homozygous and the word heterozygous don't have any meaning, right? You can't use those words for a male. Because homozygous means what? Well, it means both of the alleles are the same. He doesn't have both alleles. He doesn't have two alleles, so both doesn't make any sense, right? And heterozygous means the two alleles are different. He doesn't have two alleles, so heterozygous doesn't make any sense either. That's why we use a special word in the case of a male when we're talking about a sex-linked gene, and that word is hemizygous. Hemi means half. So compared to a male has half of the allele. She has two, he only has one. And that's why we call him hemizygous. Now there is dominance here. Red dominates over white. But a male is hemizygous. He only has one allele, and whatever it is determines the trait. Right? So he is white-eyed because the only eye color allele he has on his only one X chromosome happens to be the white version. All right? So he's true breeding white as well. True breeding is going to be obvious for a male because they only have one allele. All right. Now you get these two parents individually making gametes by meiosis, right? Meiosis is going to choose one chromosome or the other. Now, notice once again, just like in the P one that we did earlier, we don't care about any of the other chromosomes because they aren't involved in eye color. We only care about the sex chromosomes here. So since she is homozygous, it doesn't matter which one of these you pick, and therefore she can really only make one kind of egg with respect to eye color. That's why in this Punnett square there's only one row. Yes, you could have made it two rows, but the second row would be identical to the first. Because it doesn't matter which one of these you pick, it's going to be this kind of egg. On the other hand, a male is obviously going to be able to make two kinds of sperm because he has an X chromosome and a Y chromosome. So one kind of sperm will include the X, one will include the Y. When you get egg and sperm together to produce the zygotes, you have this Punnett square. We've done Punnett squares before, but now we're talking about a sex-linked gene. And when you make a Punnett square for a sex-linked cross, then you not only get information about genotype from the Punnett square, like you do normally, you also get the sex of the individual. Because the sex of the individual depends on the two chromosomes that the zygote gets. So this one is female because she got an X from her mother, which she has to get. A mother can only give X chromosomes, that's because she's XX. And she also got an X from the father. So she is XX. I shouldn't say she. This doesn't represent one fly. It represents half of the flies. Half of the flies will be female, and all of those females will be heterozygous. Right? A blue and a white allele. And therefore, phenotypically, they'll all be red-eyed because red is dominant. We see this right here. All of the females are red-eyed. Oh, I'm sorry, that's F2, right here. All of the flies are red-eyed, but that includes the females, of course. This one's a male because he got an X from his mother and a Y from his father. And the X that he got from his mother, since she was true breeding, is carrying a red allele. So he's hemizygous red, which is, of course, still red. And that's why all of the F1 are red-eyed, but in different ways. The males are red for a different reason than the females are. The females are red because red is dominant over white, and she has both. The males are red because the males are hemizygous, and that's the version they have, red. Okay, then you cross the F1s with F1s. So this one's going to mate with this one. They're going to make their own gametes. Well, now, since the female involved here is heterozygous, she can make two different kinds of eggs. You can choose this X chromosome or this X chromosome, and they are carrying different alleles. So there are two rows on this Punnett square for the F2. And this male, of course, can make two different kinds of sperm, either an X-carrying one or a Y-carrying one. When you get those together, notice that the first column of the Punnett square represents the females, because those are XX. And this says that half of the females should be homozygous dominant, half of them should be heterozygous. But red is dominant over white, so phenotypically they all should be red-eyed. Right? These are red-eyed, these are red-eyed too. Well, you see that here. The reason that they wrote two different females here is because these ones are heterozygous, these ones are homozygous. But they're all red-eyed. Same Punnett square on the right column showing the males says that half of the males should be white-eyed and red-eyed, and half of the males should be white-eyed. Which are those? So this isn't really a 3-to-1 ratio like we studied before, because the ratio depends on the sex. It's 100% red eye for females, 50-50 for males. Everything makes sense on all that? Okay. Let's then go to 4. Well, this is just a picture of, I think this is humans, X and Y chromosomes, to show you how drastically different in size they are. So all of these genes that are on this part of the X, they just don't exist on the Y because that part of the chromosome doesn't exist on the Y. And that's why you have males that are hemizygous, having only one allele, whereas females have two. That's unlike autosomes. Slide 5 is just a little sampling. There's a lot more possibilities. This is just a sampling of sex determination mechanism used by some animals. Keep in mind that animals are not the only sexual organisms, right? They're plants are sexual, so are other things, and they have their own determination mechanisms. But here we see some that are listed, including humans. Actually, the ones for humans, which is the XY system, is true for all mammals in general. I think that's true. But anyway, the XY system is the one we've been already looking at. Notice the genotypes of cells here. This is a male cell. This is a female cell. Why is the genotype listed as 44 plus XY? What the hell's the 44 all about? This is specifically for humans. Right. In humans, N equals 23. There's 23 overall types, but 22 of those are autosomes, and one is sex chromosomes. So the 44 refers to the fact that he has two of each of the 22 autosomes, because he is diploid, right? Plus he has an X and a Y. That's what makes him male. So when you add those all up, 44 plus the X plus the Y is 46. She's 44 plus XY. Well, when diploid humans make gametes, they are haploid, of course. And so those would be 22 plus X or 22 plus Y. This shows you, though, why, you probably already knew this, in the XY system, including humans, it's the male parent that determines the sex of the offspring. That's because the offspring is going to be either XX or XY. The female is XX, the mother is XX, so she can only give an X. That's not determining anything. Any offspring is going to get an X from the mother, and either another X, making it a female offspring, or a Y, making it a male offspring, from the father. So in the XY system, the male determines the sex of the offspring. All right, that's why you can see that two listed here for the male, only one for the female. Next is the grasshopper example. This is the so-called X0 system, which I think most people would probably call this XO, but it's actually a zero because it represents the absence. Zero is nothing. In this situation, notice for this grasshopper species, you have 22 plus XX, 22 plus X. What is N here, given that information? How many different kinds of chromosomes in this species of grasshopper? That would be the total number that a male has of chromosomes, but not types. I said how many types. N is how many types it has. Just like in humans, it's 23 types, right, of chromosomes. 22 autosomes and one sex chromosome. It's 12. There are 11 autosomes, and they're diploid, so there's two of each. That's 22, plus one sex chromosome, either an X or a Y. Just like us, it's 22 autosomes, that's why it's 44, 22 times 2, plus a sex chromosome, that's 23. But what's different here in the X0 is that there's only one kind of sex chromosome, unlike the XY. There's only an X chromosome. And therefore, it's not what kind of sex chromosome you get that makes you male or female. It's how many. If you have your 22 autosomes, 11 pairs, plus two X's, that makes you female. If you have only one X, that makes you male. Okay, so it's the X0 system because it's X and nothing else, no other kind of sex chromosome. Okay? ZW is what's used in birds. And this is, we kind of talked about this in lab when you were doing your owl experiments. The ZW system is more or less exactly the opposite of the XY. It works exactly the same way, but it's opposite with respect to which sex has two of the same and which sex has one of each. A difference, of course, is that there is no so-called X and no so-called Y. The sex chromosomes are called Z and W instead in birds. But unlike the XY system, in which the male is the one that has one of each of the two kinds of chromosomes, in birds it's the female that has one of each. So she has a Z and a W, that makes her female. He, on the other hand, has two Z's. Well, because of that being the opposite of XY, it's also true that in birds, it's not the male that determines the sex of the offspring, it's the female. Because she can make an egg with a Z or an egg with a W. He can only make a sperm with a Z. All right, so that's kind of easy to understand when you already understand how we work. It's just opposite. The weirdest one from our point of view is the bottom one here, the haplodiploid system, used in social insects like bees. In this particular bee species, there's 16 types of chromosomes. Right? N is 16. But in the haplodiploid system, there are no sex chromosomes. There's only autosomes. In this case, 16 kinds of autosomes. What makes you a male is that you have only one of each of those. You're haploid, in other words. If you're a haploid, then you're a male. If you have two of each of those chromosomes, then you're a female. Diploids are female. All right, that's why it's called haplodiploid. It's either or. Now, the weirdness I was talking about from our point of view is how this works then. First of all, one part of the weirdness is that if most animals, like we mammals, humans as an example, if a female does not fertilize her eggs, the eggs will just die pretty soon thereafter, right? If an egg is not involved in fertilization, it usually just ends its life as a single-celled egg. But bees, a female bee can lay eggs without mating. They're not fertilized eggs. And those can actually develop into bees without any fertilization. All right, now think about what's happening here. If she has, she's a diploid by definition. That's what makes her female. And so she makes her eggs by meiosis, like humans, diploids do, right? Those eggs are going to be haploid. Well, if they're not fertilized, those haploid eggs are then going to develop into haploid adults, which by definition are males. So in other words, a female bee can have sons simply by not mating. If she does mate, then sperm and egg will come together to form a diploid zygote, which by definition in the haplodiploid system will be daughters. She can make female offspring by mating, or she can just dispense with the mating, not even involve a male, and make sons. Now, when you think about that, that means that any male bee, which is a haploid, does not have a father, and cannot have a son. A male can't have a son because if a male mates, that's going to make a diploid, which is going to be a female. So he can either not reproduce or make females. And he doesn't have a father, because if he did, that would have made mother and father getting together, which would have made him female, not male. And even though a male doesn't have a father and can't have a son, a male does have a grandfather and can have grandsons. Right? He has a grandfather because, of course, he has a mother. And she was created, being a diploid, when a male and a female mated. So he has a grandmother and a grandfather that created his mother, but no father was involved, otherwise he would be a female. And he can have a grandson, because if he mates, he's going to make a female, and if she simply doesn't mate, then she'll have sons, which will be his grandsons. So it's like I said, it's bizarre from our point of view, but they probably saying the same thing about us. Okay, let's go to 6. Here we have some Punnett squares to show you some of the possibilities, not all of them, but some of the possibilities involved when you have a heritable genetic disorder. Now, a genetic disorder, just as a general term, refers to anything that involves the DNA. And that's why I said earlier when we talked about cancer that it's a genetic disorder, because the cause of the cancer is some sort of damage to the DNA, causing it to lose control of a cell cycle. That does not, cancer is not heritable, though. A heritable disorder is not only genetic, but it's a genetic disorder that's passed on. You get the disorder because of what genes you got from your parents. And in this case, we're looking at a recessive heritable genetic disorder. There's many examples, so this isn't a specific example. But in the symbols, an unfilled square refers to someone who does not have any allele leading to the disorder, so an entirely normal person. A dark red indicates a person that actually has the disorder, and a light red refers to a so-called carrier. A carrier of a genetic disorder is a heterozygote. A heterozygote has one normal allele, one defective allele. The normal allele keeps that person from having the disorder. But that person is a carrier because that defective allele can be passed on to any offspring that individual has. So what we see here in the first example is a completely normal female mating with a male that actually has the disorder. If that's true, then this Punnett square says that all of the daughters, however many they have, will be carriers. None of them will have the disorder, but all will be carriers. All of the males, on the other hand, will be totally normal, because they got their X from their mother. The middle one is a carrier female mated with a totally normal male. In that case, half of the females should be carriers, half should be totally normal. None will actually have the disorder. Half of the males, the sons, should be totally normal. Half of them should be affected. And then the worst of these three, these aren't all the possibilities, but the worst of the three in terms of the probability of getting an affected offspring is if you have a carrier female and an affected male. In that case, half of the overall children will be affected, half of the females and half of the males. The other half of the females will be carriers, and the only ones that only possible way that these two parents can make a normal offspring is if it's a male, and that's a 50-50 chance. Okay. 7. Now, I want to talk about something that has to do with dosage. Gene dosage, as it's called. We're talking once again about a sex-linked characteristic. And in this case, the characteristic is cat fur color. So a sex-linked gene that governs cat hair color. The word dosage is used for sex-linked genes because the two sexes have different dosages, so to speak, of the alleles. Right? A female for cats is an XX. So if it's a sex-linked gene, it's on the X chromosome only, and she therefore has two alleles for cat color, for fur color. A male, on the other hand, is a homozygous individual, has only one allele. So he has, in a sense, only half of the dosage of the alleles as she does. Right? That's what gene dosage refers to. And since that's an inequity, various species have evolved different mechanisms to compensate for it. We call it dosage compensation. There's two major ways you can compensate for the dosage difference in males versus females. Males have half a dose, females have a full dose. One way you could accomplish it is to bring the male up to the level of the female. Now, he only has one allele, you can't do anything about that. But if it's an allele that is very easy to transcribe, because that's what genes do, right? They get transcribed to produce eventually their proteins after translation. If it's a lot easier to turn on a gene in a male than it is in a female, then in the same amount of time, a one allele male can produce about the same amount of mRNA as a two allele female could. That would be bringing the male up to the level of the female. That's not what cats do, by the way. But that happens in certain species. The other way of accomplishing dosage compensation is to bring the female down to the level of the male. And that is what's happening here in this cat example. The way you do this, the way you bring the female down to the level of the male, is to inactivate one of the two X chromosomes in a female cell. That's why it's called X chromosome inactivation. Occurs only in females. If you did this to males, it would kill them, right? Because they only have one X chromosome. You don't want to inactivate it. But a female has two X chromosomes, so if you just inactivate one of them somehow, then that will make her just like a male, having only one usable X chromosome. Well, think back to when we talked about chromatin, which is what chromosomes are made out of, right? And we don't use that word chromosome until the chromatin that chromosomes are made out of is highly condensed, which is only when during mitosis or meiosis, right? Most of the cell cycle, you don't see chromosomes because the chromatin has to be loose in order for it to be used, in order for the genes to be able to be read by the cell. So the way that you can turn off or inactivate a chromosome is to very highly, tightly coil it up, even tighter than what you see in mitosis, so that all of the genes are just inaccessible. They're there, they just won't ever be transcribed. So in effect, even though the chromosome is there, it's not really doing anything. That's called X chromosome inactivation. Now, there's two types of females in this example, where there's two alleles for this cat color. It's either black or orange, so there's a black allele, there's an orange allele. But the two types of females are homozygous and heterozygous. Well, three types, really. Homozygous black, homozygous orange, or heterozygous. But both homozygous are really the same thing in terms of what I'm about to explain. If you're a homozygous female, then it doesn't matter which of your two X's gets inactivated, right? with respect to coat color because they're both the same version. You have two blacks, you inactivate a black, you're still going to get black hair all over your body. Two oranges, you inactivate one, you're going to be orange all over your body. But a heterozygous female is different. She has a black carrying X chromosome and an orange carrying X chromosome. Well, if you inactivate one of the two X chromosomes when it's a single cell, when it's a zygote, then that would turn that cat either into all black or all orange. Because inactivation occurs only one time, and then all of the cells that result from that already inactivated cell are going to have the same X chromosome inactivated in them. So if you turn it off, turn one of them off randomly, either black or red, when it's one cell, then the entire cat that develops from that will be either all black or all orange. That's not what happens, though. X chromosome inactivation does not happen at the zygote stage when it's only one cell. It happens in the early embryonic stage, which is multiple cells. Not as many as will be in a cat, of course, but multiple cells. It's a ball of cells. All right, that ball of cells, however many it's made of, each individual cell in that ball is going to randomly inactivate either the orange one or the black carrying X chromosome. And wherever that cell is in that ball of cells is going to correspond to a region of the body that develops from that ball of cells. And that's why in the adult cat, it's a random patchwork of orange spots and black spots. An orange spot means that that region of the embryo happened to flip the coin so that the black was turned off. And therefore, all of the cells that it gave rise to will have orange X chromosomes. And just the opposite for the black regions. All right? We call such a female a mosaic, because it's like a patchwork of traits. And in this cat example, you can just tell it by looking at her. Humans have a similar thing. Female heterozygous humans have a similar thing, but you can't tell it just by looking at them. There are mosaics with respect to the ability to freely sweat at their skin surface. So if you got in there with a microscope and looked at individual patches, there would be, on such heterozygous females, there would be some places that are able to sweat very freely and others that aren't. But you can't tell that just from looking at her. Anyway, that applies only to females and only to heterozygous individuals. Only those can be mosaics. And that's all because of X chromosome inactivation, which occurs to accomplish dosage compensation, to make the two sexes pretty much equal. And I think that's where I want to stop today.